a new reality for our labor movement, but also in universities it could be applied, because in universities, in public universities in Mexico, most of the unions are protection unions, protection for the central administration. So this possibility of using the new labor legislation in Mexico is very give us hope, the hope we did not used to have.
Javier Bravo, we want to thank you so much for being with us as we have to wrap the show. Professor of History at the University of Guanajuato in Mexico. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for Human Resources Manager. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Are you a fan of the independent film news and interviews on The Film Show? Well, you won't want to miss the new and expanded Words and Pictures, coming in 2019. That's right. The Film Show and Words and Pictures are coming together to fill the airwaves with the most creative happenings and fertile minds in screencraft, stagecraft, comics, and animation. So tune in to KBOO twice a month, 11:30 a.m. every second and fourth Thursday in 2019 and beyond, for the very best of the narrative arts on the new Words and Pictures.
Back home, folks.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland averts a municipal strike as unions reach a contract agreement with city officials. The U.S. House approves a postal service overhaul in a rare show of bipartisanship. And a key U.S.-Canada border crossing is blocked by truckers as COVID-19 protests spread. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 9th, 2022. I'm Josh Salem. Portland has averted a major municipal strike after a coalition of public employee unions reached a contract agreement with city officials. Members of the District Council of Trade Unions accepted a final offer made by the city late last week, which includes a 1.6% cost of living adjustment retroactive to last July and another 5% increase beginning next fiscal year. More than 1,100 city employees, from maintenance workers to clerical staff, had been prepared to walk off their jobs beginning Thursday morning had an agreement not been reached. The District Council of Trade Unions members make up about 16% of the city's workforce. The group's president, Rob Martineau, said a final tally showed just over 58% of members voted to accept the agreement. Martineau added, quote, over 40% of our members still wanted to strike. That, to me, shows how many of our members did not want this agreement, end quote. In addition to cost of living increases, the agreement includes a $3,000 bonus for all union members, as well as additional fringe benefits for some. The contract lasts through December of 2024. Oregon health officials reported more than 3,200 new coronavirus cases on Tuesday, continuing a general downward trend the state has seen for nearly 2 weeks. COVID-19 hospitalizations are also beginning to decline. On Tuesday, 1,055 people were hospitalized due to COVID, including 190 patients in intensive care units. The Oregon Health Authority also reported an additional 21 new deaths due to COVID-19. This brings the state's death toll up to 6,265 people. Since the beginning of the pandemic, the state has reported more than 665,000 confirmed or presumptive cases of COVID-19. Oregon health officials announced Monday that the state will lift its indoor mask mandate no later than March 31st. OHA said state health officials would consider lifting the general indoor mask requirement earlier than March 31st if hospitalizations declined at the levels projected by the end of March sooner than expected. The mask mandate will remain in place for healthcare settings. Businesses and employers can establish their own mask requirements after the state rules are lifted, and some Oregon school districts may choose to set their own masking rules. In addition, health experts strongly recommend people continue to wear masks even after the requirements are lifted if they are unvaccinated, immunocompromised, at high risk of COVID-19 hospitalization, or living with other people at high risk. Global coronavirus cases fell by 17% over the last week, according to the World Health Organization. Deaths declined by 7%. Recent data show about 97% of all cases are now caused by the Omicron variant, with just 3% coming from Delta. Omicron has been detected in nearly every country in the world. There were still greater than 19 million new cases of COVID-19 for the week ending February 6th, and 68,000 deaths. These numbers probably underestimate the true figures, according to experts. Cases fell in all World Health Organization zones except for the Eastern Mediterranean area, which reported a 36% increase. That zone includes Afghanistan, Iran, and Jordan. Cases fell by 50% in the U.S., still amounting to 1.87 million infected. Coronavirus infections were down by 7% in Europe, even though isolated countries like Russia recorded increases. The busiest traffic crossing from the U.S. to Canada, the Ambassador Bridge, which connects Detroit, Michigan, and Windsor, Ontario, remained closed on Tuesday after Canadian truckers blocked lanes to protest their government's pandemic restrictions. While all lanes were originally shut down on Monday, lanes from Canada to the U.S. have since been reopened. Canada sends 75% of its exports to the United States, and the blocked bridge usually handles around 8,000 trucks a day. Canada's Public Safety Minister, Marco Mendicino, said, quote, "We will continue to work so that we can keep the supply chains moving across the Ambassador Bridge, as well as the wheels of our economy turning," end quote. Another border crossing at Coutts, Alberta, is also currently shut down for both inbound and outbound traffic. Since January 28th, drivers demanding an end to Canada's COVID-19 vaccine mandates for cross-border traffic began blocking the streets in the nation's capital of Ottawa. Ottawa Deputy Police Chief Steve Bell told reporters on Tuesday that police have immobilized many of the heavy vehicles taking part in the blockade. He said about a quarter of the 418 protest vehicles in the downtown have children in them, and police are concerned for their well-being due to cold weather, noise, and carbon monoxide risks. New draft rules would allow the use of only one mushroom species and no chemically synthesized psilocybin under Oregon's Measure 109. Psilocybin is a hallucinogenic chemical obtained from certain mushrooms or a lab, and it has been proven to effectively treat depression. In 2020, voters passed that measure, the establishment of the Oregon Psilocybin Services Program. It allows production, possession, and administration of psilocybin by licensed service providers. Oregon also set up an advisory board to make recommendations about how to roll out a system of psilocybin use. It will probably be another year before that system can receive applications for those intending to use the drug. 200 mushroom species contain psilocybin, but the new draft rules only allow use of Psilocyb cubensis. It's one of the most popular mushrooms consumed, one of the best studied, and one of the safest. Authorities wanted to start simply and might allow use of other species later. Critics have already said that limit is too drastic because other mushrooms might promote different experiences. The Oregon Health Authority also aims to regulate mushroom production testing and training for people assisting others in taking the drug. Oregon is the first state to have created this type of system of regulation. Manufacturers have to use food-grade equipment in a lockable area. Psilocybin products cannot be made in shapes appealing to minors, such as cute animals. The psilocybin must be taken by mouth. The draft rules do not discuss microdosing, that is, taking small amounts every day. The Psilocybin Advisory Board wants training to pay particular attention to diversity, cultural equity, and racial injustice. The state is running a survey to find out how many people plan to use psilocybin. Some predict it could grow to become a billion-dollar national industry. The AARP Community Grant Challenge is accepting applications for projects that make communities more livable and that can be completed within a few months. The grant provides a chance for organizations and local governments to try new ideas. Eric Tegetoff has more on the story.
Local organizations and governments in Oregon looking for funding for their projects now have an opportunity with AARP's Community Challenge Grant. Applications are open for the 6th annual program, which awards out small grants to projects that help make communities more livable. Bandana Shrestha, State Director of AARP Oregon, says challenge grants are designed to support projects that can be turned around quickly.
They should be projects that hopefully get people excited on a new idea, fast-tracking new ideas, or to build momentum on an existing project. And we're particularly looking for projects that prioritize and support residents 50+.
She says AARP looks for projects that engage communities by creating more vibrant public spaces or improving housing or transportation. Applications are being accepted through March 22nd, and the selected projects must be completed by November 30th. This year, AARP also is calling for projects that leverage funding through laws like the American Rescue Plan Act or the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. Marilyn Daly Blair's organization, Center 50 Plus in Salem, received a grant for a downtown summer pop-up in 2019, which engaged people in hands-on education and ways to navigate the city's public transit system.
The challenge grant is just that. It's a challenge to your community to create the community you want for everyone. And for us here in Salem, it was building a place for all ages and abilities where they can live and thrive for a lifetime.
AARP Oregon is holding an informational session online on February 22nd to help guide prospective applicants in how to submit proposals. Since 2017, 16 projects in Oregon have been funded, with grants totaling more than $200,000. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
The U.S. House of Representatives has approved a postal service overhaul in a rare show of bipartisanship. The bill takes several actions to decrease the postal service's fiscal burdens, while being more transparent about service levels. One major change will be releasing the Postal Service from its current legal obligation to finance in advance healthcare benefits for current and retired workers for the next 75 years. No other agency or company in the country has that burden. The bill also requires the agency to continue Saturday Postal Service and will create a website where customers can track delivery speed by zip code. The Postal Service had a successful 2021 holiday season, delivering 97% of shipments on time during 2 weeks in December. Missing from the bill is any criticism of current Postmaster General DeJoy. Meanwhile, the Postal Service is drawing criticism for its plan to spend over $11 billion on new vehicles, 90% of them gasoline-powered, with a fuel efficiency of just 8.3 miles per gallon. Vicky Arroyo, the Environmental Protection Agency's Associate Administrator for Policy, wrote, quote, "The Postal Service's proposal, as currently crafted, represents a crucial lost opportunity to more rapidly reduce the carbon footprint of one," end quote. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for an in-depth interview with Julianne Jackson, Director of Movement Building for the Partnership for Safety and Justice in Portland, about Oregon Senate Bill 1510, which would prohibit police officers from initiating traffic stops based solely on broken headlights or taillights, and require they inform people of their right to refuse to consent to a search. Then, at 6, it's Rhythm Nation with Peter Marks. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 42 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high of 53 degrees. Today in history, in 1918, the first peace treaty of World War I is signed when the newly declared independent state of Ukraine officially comes to terms with the Central Powers in Berlin, Germany. In the treaty, the Central Powers, which included the governments of Austria-Hungary, Bulgaria, Germany, and Turkey, formally recognized the independence of Ukraine from Russia. The quote of the day is from American contralto singer Marian Anderson, who said, quote, "No matter how big a nation is, it is no stronger than its weakest people. And as long as you keep a person down, some part of you has to be down there to hold him down. So it means you cannot soar as you might otherwise," end quote. Thank you. Britain's top diplomat just traveled to Moscow, trying to defuse tensions raised by Russia's military buildup near Ukraine. This is the first such visit in more than 4 years. Foreign Secretary Liz Truss said an invasion would lead to, quote, massive consequences, end quote, and encouraged Russia to de-escalate and choose the path of diplomacy. Russia has placed more than 100,000 troops near the Ukrainian border. It has repeatedly said it has no plans to invade. Russia wants the North American Treaty Organization to keep Ukraine and other former Soviet nations from joining as members. The US and NATO have rejected that and other demands. Western nations do plan extremely rigid sanctions on Russian businesses and individuals in the event of an invasion. Russia was warned not to doubt the strength of that response. Truss also urged Russia to abide by international agreements and respect Ukrainian sovereignty. Other Western leaders have also recently engaged in high-stakes diplomacy. The French president met with Vladimir Putin for more than 5 hours Monday, and the German chancellor and Polish president also urged Russian de-escalation. Russia's deputy foreign minister, Sergei Rybkov, criticized the U.S. and allies for pressuring Moscow. The U.S. and Europe have been preparing for the impact of Russia cutting off natural gas supplies, and NATO has deployed more troops to its eastern flank. Colonel Joe Ewers, commanding the first troops to arrive in Romania, said, quote, "We are always prepared to meet any mission as is required, but the focus will be on training," end quote. Russia has moved up to 30,000 troops, 2 battalions of surface-to-air missile systems, and numerous fighter jets into Belarus for joint training exercises with the Belarusian army that will begin tomorrow. Much of the hardware is now located close to the border. Belarus is located on Ukraine's northern border. From the border, it is only about 130 miles down a highway to Kiev, Ukraine's capital. Russia has amassed more than 100,000 troops near Ukraine's eastern and southern borders. Belarus President Alexander Lukashenko said that if the Ukrainian military attacks insurgents in southeast Ukraine, the Belarusian army will act in exactly the same way as the Russian army. Lukashenko added, quote, "It will be a joint response," end quote. In Romania, near Ukraine's western border, the first 100 of 3,000 U.S. troops in support of NATO soldiers arrived yesterday. House lawmakers passed a stopgap bill to avoid a shutdown. Senator Mitch McConnell calls January 6th a violent insurrection, and the U.S. Surgeon General testifies on young Americans' worsening mental health. With more on this story, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It was a violent insurrection for the purpose of trying to prevent the peaceful transfer of power after a legitimately certified election from one administration to the next.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell responding to reporters Tuesday on the events of January 6, 2021. He also said the Republican National Committee shouldn't single out individual members who don't agree with the rest of the party. House lawmakers have passed a stopgap bill to avoid a government shutdown and buy Congress more time to strike a deal to fund the government for the rest of the fiscal year. The continuing resolution funds the government through March 11th. Texas Rabbi Charlie Citron Walker, who escaped a hostage takeover at his synagogue last month, testified before Congress for the first time on Tuesday about his ordeal, detailing why he opened the door for the attacker last month and how he and others were able to flee after the hours-long standoff.
I welcomed a terrorist into my congregation. I live with that responsibility.
The rabbi urged lawmakers to increase funding for a federal program that bolsters security at houses of worship at risk of attack. U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy testified at a Senate Finance Committee hearing focused on the mental health of children and teenagers. Murthy on the negative effects of social media.
Messages that tell our kids with greater frequency and volume than ever before that they are not good-looking enough, not popular enough, not smart enough, not rich enough, simply not enough.
Senators expressed bipartisan support for addressing mental health issues among young people amid recent increases in attempted suicides. Renters from across the country testified Tuesday about their living conditions and what they described as predatory practices by property owners and management companies. Brooklyn renter Antu Wang on the decision by the private equity firm that owns her building to sell it last year.
One day later, on March 22nd, I received a notice to vacate in the midst of the ongoing COVID pandemic.
First Lady Jill Biden says President Joe Biden will no longer promote 2 years of tuition-free community college as part of his Build Back Better agenda. Dr. Biden spoke Monday at the Community College National Legislative Summit in Washington, D.C. U.S. lawmakers are threatening to investigate GoFundMe after the website shut down fundraising for the Freedom Convoy. Organizers of the convoy had raised more than $10 million Canadian dollars. Trucks and protesters have occupied downtown Ottawa for more than a week in what began as a movement against vaccine mandates. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Indigenous groups oppose trucker protests. Haskell students get a win for free speech. And leaders gear up for the NCAI winter session. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Indigenous groups have condemned Canada's trucker protests and symbols. Dan Karpinchuk reports, one Native leader says the so-called Freedom Convoy is a result of unabashed entitlement among privileged Canadians.
Several Native groups say they do not support the trucker convoy protest in Ottawa. One First Nation, the Algonquin Nations, says it does not support the setting up of a teepee, the pipe ceremony, and a sacred fire in Ottawa's Confederation Park. It says it did not give consent for the ceremonial practices, and they could cause more harm to First Nations. The Manitoba Métis Federation also says the use of Métis symbols during the protests is inappropriate and unacceptable. David Chartrand is the president of the federation.
I think they're trying to drag in the Indigenous message that they got support from Indigenous people, and there is no way that we support this.
A First Nation chief in Manitoba, Derek Nepinak, says the so-called Freedom Convoy is a result of unabashed entitlement among privileged Canadians.
Canada's privilege or economy has been built on the oppression of Indigenous people. That has not changed, and those truths continue to build around this knowledge. How can I put energy into supporting a freedom convoy when we're still trying to find our lost children?
Other Native leaders question whether the protest is really about health and vaccine mandates and speculate whether there is another agenda behind it. One Indigenous advocate said it's sad to see the kind of attention the trucker protest has raised and the children of residential schools being found, as well as the calls for action on the number of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, is all but silent. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A former tribal college student who fought for the rights of student journalists has won. Jared Nally has settled a lawsuit against leadership of Haskell Indian Nations University in Kansas. Nally, former editor of the student newspaper, The Indian Leader, fought back after the former president of Haskell officially instructed him to stop engaging in news and information gathering in October 2020. The Foundation for Individual Rights and Education backed Nally and helped him with a lawsuit against the school. On Tuesday, the U.S. District Court for the District of Kansas ordered Haskell to adopt policy reforms to protect the First Amendment rights of students and safeguard the editorial independence of the student newspaper. Nally says the immediate impact will help protect free speech on campus, but hopes there will be similar impacts for students at other tribal colleges and universities across the country.
It might inspire other students who have things to say and input for the school to be able to take a stand. And I think we are being watched as everything plays out publicly, that other schools, other TCUs even, really look at this as an example on what a relationship with the student press needs to be, and that there are consequences if students or if universities try to stifle students.
Nally graduated from Haskell last fall. He's considering graduate school and is currently a guest editor at a magazine. Under the settlement, the university must pay $40,000 in attorney's fees. One claim still stands, which is expected to continue at the Supreme Court, to hold federal officials accountable for their actions. Haskell is a federally operated university. Tribal leaders from across the country are gearing up for the National Congress of American Indians winter session, which kicks off Sunday. NCAI President Fawn Sharp will deliver the State of Indian Nations address Monday. Native American Congresswoman Cherise Davids will give the congressional response. And U.S. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland will update tribal leaders on federal initiatives. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Solar stills produce clean water using the power of the sun. As droughts make water scarcer, every drop counts. Dr. Anthony Lizowicz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowicz, and this is Climate Connections. Hundreds of millions of people around the world lack easy access to safe drinking water, and water scarcity is expected to worsen as droughts become more extreme.
With climate change, water is just becoming a bigger issue.
Robert Foster is the chairman of the American Solar Energy Society. He says one small-scale solution is to use the sun to purify any water that is available, such as contaminated well water. It's an age-old technique called solar distillation. The sun heats up water in a glass-covered basin. The water evaporates, leaving salt and impurities behind. That pure water vapor condenses on the glass and runs down to a trough where it can be collected. Foster says most stills produce only a couple gallons of drinking water each day, but it can help people who have few other options. Foster has helped equip families along the U.S.-Mexico border with solar stills to purify well water polluted with arsenic and fluoride. And he's worked with Pacific Islanders who use stills to turn salt water into fresh drinkable water.
So it's a great opportunity for people to clean their water who might not otherwise have an easy way to do it. You don't need electricity, you just need sunlight.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is hip to hypocrisy.
Can you be a hypocrite if you don't believe what you're saying? Make all the campaign promises you want, the quote-unquote voters won't be able to hold you responsible. The Supreme Court upheld Alabama's gerrymandering, which is so blatant even Justice Roberts disagreed. Not quite the groundhog. Governor Brown promises in 6 weeks the mask mandates will go away, maybe, and she can't run for re-election. Meanwhile, Mayor Wheeler, who also can't run again, gives police more leeway to clear out homeless camps along busy streets, supposedly because 8 houseless people were killed by vehicles last year, while the 8 safe encampments he promised to have built by the end of last year turned out to be zero. So many distractions, so we'll pay no attention to high rents, inflation, strangled supply chains, to the accelerated corrosion of our political and economic systems, our sense of community, when the only people I see are making deliveries, then dashing to the next to get enough money to pay for $4 a gallon gas. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 9th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Josh Salem. Their producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Nadia Ramlagan, Michaela Savitt, Eric Tegetoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowicz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. Coming up tomorrow at KBOO, at 8, it's Sojourner Truth Radio, bringing you news and views on policies that affect us all. At 9, it's With Good Reason. At 10, it's American Standoff. Host Jacqueline Keeler examines the current political divide in America from an indigenous perspective. At 11, it's Jonesy. Host Ken Jones introduces you to the most interesting people in the world of literature, art, and humor. Then at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures. Pulitzer Prize-winning graphic novelist Art Spiegelman addresses censorship controversies. All of these KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth interview with Julianne Jackson, Director of Movement Building for the Partnership for Safety and Justice. We'll be right back.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
On Tuesday, February 8th, protesters met with Senator Ron Wyden and also with Representative Earl Blumenauer to encourage them to say no to military escalation in Russia and Ukraine, and urged Senator Wyden to withdraw his co-sponsorship that would aid Ukraine with $500 million in military aid. Prior to their meeting with the senator, protesters gathered this weekend in front of Senator Wyden's offices. Protesters from the groups Veterans for Peace, Code Pink, and Extinction Rebellion spoke with this reporter about why they want Ron Wyden to withdraw his support for military aid to the Ukraine.
No war with Russia! No war with Russia!
My mask is okay?
Yeah, it's fine. Okay. So, hi, can you tell me your name?
Yeah, my name is Janet Weil, W-E-I-L.
Great, and are you with an organization?
Yes, I'm with two organizations who jointly organized this with Extinction Rebellion, XRPDX, and with Veterans for Peace.
Oh, great. And so, yeah, I remember seeing your name on the website now.
Uh-huh.
So why is it important to come out today? I mean, a lot of people think of Senator Wyden as being